Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. At one time or another, a lot of us think about getting a part-time job. But if you've ever sat in the glow of your computer at the end of a long day and retouched a photo to put up online, or bugged a few coworkers about endorsing you on LinkedIn, or even booked a flight for your family, Ian Bogost argues that you have a part-time job, a whole bunch of them, actually. He calls this phenomenon hyperemployment, the feeling that work is never done. And a lot of that work is pro bono. Bogost is a professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and he's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He's here with me now. Ian, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have described this concept of hyperemployment. Is that just about keeping up with emails, or are you really talking about some kind of fundamental change in the economy?
Emails are a part of it, but I think hyperemployment is bigger than just, you know, taking your work home with you and puttering around on your laptop or your smartphone. If you kind of think about all the ways that we do more work than we used to do or than we think we do even, you'll start to see all of these little places where overemployment is sort of leaking out of our day. So, you know, the stuff that's obvious is the work you bring home or having to be on call, feeling like you have to look at your phone in the coffee line or whatever in case an important work email comes in. But then there's the work we don't even know that we're doing, things like contributing our data inadvertently to companies like Google and Facebook, which they benefit from the work that we do socializing or searching through their platforms. And then there's the work that we do thanks to automation. So when you don't use a travel agent but book your flight or your hotel online, it feels more convenient. But another feature of that phenomenon is that you're now doing a job, the job of the travel agent, that you wouldn't have been doing. If you kind of stop and you take a survey of your day and think about all of the work that in past eras we wouldn't have done but would have outsourced to others who would have been professionals and would have been paid to do that work, you'll see that it's almost everywhere.
You know, I have to say that to some degree, I really do sympathize with this concept because I'm in the media and you're supposed to sort of get out there and brand yourself and do Facebook and do Twitter and get followers. And honestly, sometimes at the end of the day, you know, writing a whole bunch of tweets, it feels like doing an additional job. I mean, I wonder, is that just a media thing or does it go beyond that?
I certainly think those of us who work in the media feel that very strongly with social media, that we have to maintain a public persona. And for many people on Instagram or on Twitter or on Facebook, they don't feel that at all. They just feel like they're interacting with their friends. But increasingly, it's the case that your public persona is also work that you're expected to do. And maybe you're not required to do it for yourself, but you might be required to do it for others. So, you know, you're working as a volunteer in your church or in your community, and you've got to somehow get the word out. And so you take on that role. Or in other cases, you kind of have to do that work in order just to keep up with the way that we communicate. You know, you have to have your LinkedIn page updated, or you have to kind of maintain some sort of a presence. Previously, maybe there would have been formal marketing agencies or departments or personnel who would have been responsible for this sort of work. And I don't think that's just a media industry phenomenon. Everywhere else, you're kind of asked to do these little things and you feel like, oh, this isn't so bad. I can do that. The tools are made available to me. I can submit my expense reports through this, you know, PeopleSoft system that's been set up so that we can take out some of the inefficiencies in our procurement or our accounting departments. But you kind of add all of them up. All of those little things, the marketing and the accounting and the management of procurement, all the little stuff you do, the ordinary kind of boring stuff that you do, and it adds up to, you know, the equivalent of maybe multiple other jobs.
Right. Well, you know, you talked before about somebody, let's say, volunteering for their church or whatever. Now, people have always volunteered for their church, but is this the notion that in addition to just doing the volunteer work, you also may be saying, hey, we got to raise money and being the sort of public presence of that.
It's certainly true that we've always had these kind of avocations that we've thought of as avocations or as volunteering or as contributing to our communities. But one of the reasons why we were previously motivated or we felt like we had time to do that was because we had more of our work life sort of kept at bay. You might have gotten a phone call occasionally. But unless you were a lawyer or a doctor, someone who really needed to be on call, a CEO, an executive, then you could keep a lot of your work at work and it wouldn't sort of seep back into your home life. So already by the time that you're going to the church or the school or whatever to do the thing that you're going to do that you would do anyway under any circumstances, you're in a different mental state and you've been so overburdened that it's changed the feeling, the sort of sensation of doing that volunteer work is now, oh gosh, here's another thing. And it has the same form also sometimes of the work, the hyper-employment work. And that has changed that activity from being a kind of secondary, I'm going to do this for the benefit of the community I live in, to, oh, here's yet another example of me trying to, you know, find a way to get people to contribute to this funding campaign on this crowdfunding site, or another way that I'm trying to get followers for another Twitter account, right? So that parallelism, I think, has also changed the tenor of volunteer work, of non-work work.
So if you add up all these jobs, the submitting expense reports that maybe somebody else used to do, and maybe reading an analytics report for a website and trying to figure it out, and maybe learning a little basic code and potentially trying to launch a Kickstarter campaign, where is this going? I mean, how many more hours a day can we possibly work?
Right. Well, one of the things that we've started to do is to outsource some of that work to others. You know, the so-called sharing economy, which is this sort of euphemism for taking things that used to be stable jobs and turning them into these aggregated middleman-free service providers like Uber and TaskRabbit and whatever. But another direction, I think, is just that we will all be continuing to do these little pickup jobs, and less and less of our work life will be stabilized in the way that it has been in the past. So for the hyper-employment picture that I've been painting thus far to make sense, it still sort of assumes that you have a quote-unquote normal job. You're going into an office and you're working 9 to 5, you know, the weekdays and that sort of thing. But for those who already haven't had the benefit of such stability, who are splitting shifts or, you know, trying to take on additional shifts at multiple part-time jobs, they've already been feeling that sense of how do I even like put together a legitimate living out of all these little bits and pieces? And then on top of it, I've got to do all the work of being under-resourced in the way that those kinds of more menial jobs or less well-paying jobs offer. So maybe we're sort of turning part of the middle class into a phenomenon that operates, that feels similar to the way that some of the underclasses have felt for a very long time. And maybe we ignored those phenomena to our own peril, thinking that the white-collar work was safe.
You've actually said that hyper-employment, it's kind of counterintuitive, even extends to the unemployed. How?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the work that we do as hyper-employed work isn't work that we get paid for in the first place. I mentioned, you know, the work that you do for Facebook inadvertently by virtue of just being on their platform. But then there's all the work that we have to do just to be employable in the first place. So, you know, one of the phenomena that I would roll into this category is the phenomenon of internships, paid or unpaid, spending a lot of time seeking out these sort of quasi-positions which once used to take on the role of training inside of legitimate jobs, but which are now, you know, increasingly something you have to come to the table with even before you get a contract. You see this in part in the way that teenagers and college students can't get jobs the way that they used to be able to. I teach at a university. I see, you know, the students trying to get internships and trying to get co-op jobs during the term or during the summers much harder than it used to be. There's a lot more competition, and so now you've got to work even harder. And one of the phenomena we sometimes see at Georgia Tech, for example, are these like hackathons. And this is a term that's often used in software development, but it's extended to almost anything where, you know, a company will come in and sort of sponsor an initiative where a bunch of kids get together and they get free pizza and they solve some problem for the company, you know, for free, basically. And then there's a prize and maybe they're selected. The same sort of phenomenon that exists with like the XPRIZE competition, $250,000, $1 million to improve Netflix's algorithm. And they feel like they're opportunities, but then you sit down and think about it and realize, actually I'm doing free work on spec, and then, you know, it's really all kind of a lottery who's gonna get picked. And then if you win, it's some sort of social capital, I suppose, or maybe even get some sort of legitimate good feeling about it. But it's not the same as having a legitimate full-time job. So all that precarity, is a part of the hyper-employment phenomenon.
Do you think that people who grew up in this kind of economy are better at doing the juggling act, at dealing with what you call hyper-employment versus like people who are just trying to transition to it?
on the surface, they appear better. And of course, we have this rhetoric about, you know, so-called millennials, which is now so numerous that it's almost meaningless to use the phrase, so-called millennials sort of being better at multitasking or better at using digital technology or social media. And it's true in some respects and false in others. You know, certainly when you grow up with something like social media or computing, it's not the case that you're automatically better at it. It becomes ground. You don't even realize that it's there, and it structures your thought in a way that is very different from, you know, the boomer or the early Gen Xer or something who sort of worked through the transition and is aware of the need to move from one mode to another.
Right.
So there may be a sense in which younger folks are better at managing the moment-to-moment experience of shifting between different media. But inside, I think they're not equipped, and maybe no one is, but they're being asked to do so much more and to internalize not only all of the hyper-employment-style labor, but to do so without a safety net or without a base, a material base on which to do so. Hmm. So for me, you know, I'm in a privileged position. I've got a job. I've got benefits. I've got tenure. And all of those things make it easy for me to sit here today and talk to you about the media in a sort of disconnected way. Whereas if you're living it, you know, you're 21, 22 years old and you're trying to get a job, it's not theoretical like that. You're
right.
Really, you know, just trying to find a way to get by.
Finally, how do you feel like this is changing us as people? Because we've talked a lot about the sort of employment thing, all the duties that we have, and the kind of list that's racking up all the time. How about the sort of personal effects here?
I think the big thing is the way that we've internalized all this work. We don't really think about it as burdensome anymore. We think about it as naturalized. Increasingly, we think of it as naturalized. You know, I get something out of using Facebook and Google and Instagram and what have you. That's not really work. Or, well, of course I'm going to, you know, fill out these forms on online. Or, of course I'm going to assume that, you know, doing some of this social media work or laying out my article or doing whatever it is that's sort of asked for, that's become internalized. And to some extent, the hyperemployment phenomenon is a it speaks to our desire to be perceived and to feel important in the way that previously executives and professionals were deemed important by virtue of how much they worked. A while back, I used the example of the physician or the attorney or the CEO, and I think those are good models. You know, the lawyer who's working all night at the office,
right,
on the big case, and the doctor who's always on call, literally, you know, with the pager, which is one of the places where this phenomenon of being always available started, but had, you know, more legitimacy because people's lives were on the line, or the executive who's, you know, constantly making important decisions or is perceived to be, you know, doing deals late into the night. And those are kind of our cultural heroes, right? For better or worse, we look at overwork as a value. We've embodied that value in a surprising way, which is not by means of helping people necessarily, or even by means of accruing a capital, which is another value that we have as a society, but rather by means of appearing to do the same amount of work as those sorts of professions, which we used to think of as doing so in exchange for the potential to make a lot more money. Now you do it because that's what you do.
Ian Bogost is a professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Ian, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.